Welcome to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld.
This episode is produced in cooperation with Independent Art Fair New York City. It will be part of the fair's OVR.
I'm Daniela, and this podcast is about my personal and also about a lot of other people's enthusiasm for art. Art can touch on all parts of life, and therefore we talk about all parts of life. I hope to get you on board and to tell you interesting stories you enjoy listening to. We're recording via the internet, so please excuse any glitches and sound quality. So today is January 23, 2024, and my guest is Anton Swiatsky. You know what? I didn't ask you how your name is pronounced rightly.
Swiatsky.
Okay. So Anton, he was born in 1991 in Moscow. I have to say we already started a little bit talk before that. So this is going to be really an interesting one, I think. Anton is an American philosopher and curator based in New York. And he has worked on parallel programs for different biennials and has been a guest lecturer at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, Savannah College of Art and Design, and much, much more. You are still the studio director of your father's art collective, AES plus F. And why you are here is because you run the gallery management, which will be exhibiting at Independent. And this is going to be the second part of our talk. We're going to talk about what you're going to be presenting at Independent with management. But first of all, Anton, you're born in Moscow, you're living in New York City, your dad is an artist. Tell me about your childhood.
First of all, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yes, I forgot to say hello.
You've done your homework and you know everything about me.
Okay, then we can stop right now. No, I know nothing. Just go ahead.
Well, yes. So I was born in Moscow and then my family immigrated to New York, to South Brooklyn, actually, with my mother and my brother. My parents have been separated since I was little. But I still have a very close relationship with my father, obviously, mm-hmm. since I work for him. I mean, it's a typical immigrant story. We left Russia in 2002. I was 10, almost 11. Came to South Brooklyn, didn't speak a word of English, and sort of made my way from there, you know? Went to public school.
Yeah, but it must have been a big difference, I think, growing up with an artist as a father compared to a bank accountant.
Yeah, you know, many people would have preferred
the bank accountant.
A banker, yes, if they had lived even for a short time with an artist. But, you know, you don't really know because you have nothing to compare it to as a child, right? So you just know your own experience. And to me, it seemed perfectly normal that my dad would be traveling, you know, 10 months out of the year, and then I wouldn't see him very much.
Ah, okay. Because he could have been also 10 months of the year just in the studio, and you could visit
yes.
every day.
Right. But, you know, it's a collective. They were showing a lot in the 90s. Mm-hmm. What I do know, however, and this is often mentioned to me, is that among all of the children growing up in the 90s, I was one of very, very few who actually had diapers. Because my dad would bring them from Germany when he traveled.
Okay, so you grew up very clean.
I grew up very clean.
Very clean
and very
child.
Pampered.
A very pampered child.
Exactly.
Yes, but you said you have your own experience, your personal experience. You have nothing to compare to, so it's perfectly normal. But at some point you must have realized, that it's probably special and that you have to find your own way with it. And I don't think it's to be taken for granted that somebody who grows up in an artist family works in the arts. Probably the opposite can happen. You know, how was your way into the arts?
I was trying to avoid it for most of my life.
I can understand that.
But, you know, as some things are just unavoidable, I guess. I was a troublesome teenager. And actually, the first time that I came to the realization that having a famous artist for a parent is different and special in many ways. I was a teenager. I was around 15, 16. And my dad with his collective represented Russia at the Venice Biennial. And so we went there the year before to kind of see everything. And I traveled with him quite a bit when I was around 16 to different exhibitions in Austria and Italy. And that was an eye-opening experience because until then, I just, you know, I assumed that they had exhibitions, the collective, I mean, had exhibitions everywhere, but I never actually saw or attended any of them, at least not that I remember.
And then it kind of like drew you in. You said like, oh, wow, yeah, that's something really interesting.
It was interesting for a teenager, right? Because you get a lot of free alcohol and nobody checks your ID. But generally, I didn't see the work aspect of it. I just saw, you know, the kind of glamour of it. I was a very introverted kid also. So to me, it wasn't that attractive other than the alcohol part and like the free pizza. Eventually, it did lead to an interest in art history, which I credit to my dad and his collective.
And you studied art history then?
I did. I was an autodidact for most of my teenage years because the American public education system didn't really agree with me in many things. And so I had to sort of educate myself and find my own way through it.
How did you do that?
The first step was to drop out of high school.
Yeah, very good decision.
And then kind of learn on my own. I took the standardized tests in New York and I scored very high. I wanted to go to a public university, so I went to CUNY. I didn't want to put any financial strain on my parents. And my mom was really struggling to adapt to American society, so I didn't want to burden her financially. So I went to Brooklyn College, which turned out to be one of the top schools for philosophy. And I knew I wanted to study philosophy when I went. I didn't know that about Brooklyn College. I didn't realize that it was actually a very good program.
So it was a lucky punch.
Yeah, very much so. And I didn't apply anywhere else. It was sort of the closest school to where I had lived at the time in South Brooklyn. And I went, I double majored in philosophy and art history, graduated summa cum laude, and wanted to be a philosopher. I wanted to go get a PhD in philosophy, but by that time I had already begun working and I worked through all of college. I had a design studio. So I was doing a lot of branding since I was around 19.
Well, you were self-employed? It was your own design studio?
Yes. I worked with a lot of architects and artists doing branding for them, for their studios.
Philosophy is a lot about thinking, but design studio is a lot about of making.
Yeah, it was very practical. It was a very practical decision. Like I said, I was autodidactic, so I learned everything on my own. I learned programming, I learned design, I learned the rules of branding, I learned business by having one.
Mm-hmm. And you were pretty fearless.
I mean, what was there to fear?
Oh, you know, for some people, dropping out of high school and being autodidactic and just going your own way is fearsome. For others, it's the only way.
I'm leaving a lot of details out, of course. But yeah, I think in retrospect, it was reckless what I did. But it was really difficult, I want to say decade, since I arrived in America. And I'd only begun to accept who I was and what I was doing after I got to university.
You know, I mean, as a philosopher, would your aim have been writing books, becoming a teacher? Did you have an idea or was it just like an interest and you said, I just wing it, I go from there?
There's a funny story there. When I had just graduated or I was about to graduate, and I just finished my thesis in metaphysics. It was an overview of all theories on causation. It was a very long thesis, especially for an undergrad, and I had many hopes placed upon me by the faculty of my department. But one professor, actually, the professor for metaphysics, knew me quite well, and he was my thesis advisor. When I talked to him about me getting a PhD and getting his recommendation, the first question he asked me was, do you plan on teaching? And I said, no. And he breathed such a genuine sigh of relief and said, thank God, you would make a terrible teacher.
Why that?
He knew me quite well, and I agree with him. I have very little patience when it comes to interactions with other people.
Oh, but then you have the perfect job now, huh?
Yes, exactly. This is why I decided to become a gallerist. No, it was a long and winding and circuitous road to this point. But that was when I decided, okay, the PhD can really kind of wait and I can go out into the real world and I can make some money and then I can go get a PhD. And we're still waiting for that moment.
And you never got it.
No, not yet.
Not yet. Oh, yeah.
The gallery business, I realized, is not one where you go to make a lot of money.
Not
right away.
No, not right away, but potentially.
Potentially. Maybe after independent Well, we will get to that.
Yeah, sure.
So yeah, I mean, after university, I just continued working on my business, my design studio. I was building a lot of websites. Then I got into completely different industry. I started building tools for financial technology companies or fintech companies.
That's a wide range you seem to be capable of, from philosophy to financial companies.
I've worn a lot of hats. I've definitely worn a lot of hats. It's sort of because of the nature of the kind of design, and especially web design business, it allowed me to basically get all of this knowledge and experience in building digital infrastructure. That means, you know, websites, different kinds of systems for managing information and data. And most of my life is serendipity. So I met a guy while I was working on some big project, and he asked me to actually make him a personal family website. And this was the most annoying person in the world. And if he's listening to this, he knows exactly who he is.
Okay.
He's also one of my best friends now. After I had done this small job for him, he kind of latched onto me and had me do a lot of other jobs for him. And he's in the financial sector. So I ended up making a lot of tools that he uses to this day for his company. And that's how I started learning also about the different financial markets, commodity trading, all sorts of things. So I ended up having a deep understanding of how the trading world works, the financial trading world.
So do you think that you learned something you can apply right now for the gallery?
No, but I did make the money necessary to open one.
The gallery you opened 2021.
Yeah.
So before you curated, or what was the thing? Yeah. You kind of like wiggled your way more and more into the art world.
Yeah, I think wiggled is the right word to describe it. It was like a meandering curiosity within the arts. And obviously I had a lot of artist friends because of my dad. I was actually much more embedded in the art scene in Eastern Europe because I would go back to Russia periodically. And Moscow was a kind of hub for the Eastern European art scene for a long time, at least until 2014, mm-hmm. when, you know, it all went to hell.
Yeah.
So a lot of artists had been asking me to curate their work or to curate a group show, and gallerists started asking me to curate group shows. And I did that for a bit. I curated a number of group shows. I had a big project I was working on in 2019 when the pandemic hit. That sort of was pivotal, I think, in my career, because otherwise I would have continued pursuing just curation and doing independent projects, because everything was sort of going well and stable up until mm-hmm. that moment. And then when the pandemic hit, I had to close my design studio. I had to sort of stop everything else I was doing and figure out what I was going to do next, because all of my curatorial projects were also on hold. A lot of my clients went out of business during COVID.
And so it's the best time to open a gallery.
It was. Well, initially, I wanted to go and join an existing gallery. I wanted to go and work for somebody. And I tried getting a job, but I didn't have the correct credentials to get a job at a more established gallery. So my friend John Huddleston offered me a position at False Flag, which is what I was doing all of 2020. I was sort of running that project. And then I decided to open my own space around April of 2021. And began working on making that a reality.
A gallery can be a lot of things, you know, and galleries are super individual sometimes due to their owners or the people that run it. And the decision came out of that during COVID, everything's changed so much. Or is there anything specific where you say, yeah, the gallery, that's just the right thing for me? And if yes, what would that be?
Well, I wouldn't chalk it up to any kind of specific event. You know, it was just during COVID, I had actually a great time because, like I mentioned before, I'm an introvert. And so I got a chance to sit home with my thoughts for a while. And all I was pretty much doing at that time, since all of my projects were on hiatus, was trading. I was trading. And then that's how I kind of made the money necessary to open the space in 2021. But I think it was rejection. It was this gradual rejection of me as a candidate, a curatorial candidate for any institution.
Because you didn't have the PhD, or you didn't have the right credentials.
I didn't have the credentials or the connections, frankly, because the only people in the art world that I knew were artists. I knew some curators, of course, I knew some gallerists, but I didn't really know many people in the New York art world, or at least not in any capacity in which they would be interested in what I was doing or who I was.
But to open then a gallery without those connections is also a bold move.
Very, very risky.
As you must know by now.
Very risky.
Because all the clients, yes. If nobody knows you, you know, I think it's great actually, because we're talking also because a new generation of galleries opening up in New York City, and hopefully with a new agenda or some different thoughts. So you might take something off the old art world you think is useful or very good, but you might add also something. That would be interesting to me. So you just really jump into that. And we didn't talk about the visual aspect. We were talking about the thinking, about the trading,
yeah.
But not the visual aspect, because it's visual art in the end, I think. So how do you go about that to choose artists, for example? You want to represent all these things.
Well, I approached it very methodically, I think, as a philosopher would.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I have my personal taste. And my personal taste informs most of the decisions I make. But I do have two formal criteria for deciding to work with someone. The first criteria is originality. I always look for things that defy categorization, that defy easy explanations, that are hybrid in the way that I feel like I am. And in that sense, I relate to a lot of the work that I show. And the second criteria is sincerity. Sincerity in the sense that I want the artists I work with to be obsessed with what they're doing, to genuinely and sincerely believe in the subjects that they're working with, that they're incorporating, to believe also in themselves as agents of complication,
mm-hmm.
as agents of expansion of discourse. To me, that's probably the most important criteria for selection, is that sincerity. And I feel like it's very rare also, especially in the US, because the education system in the US forces artists to conform to whatever trend is currently favored, or whatever mode of expression is currently favored, which is a shame, because I've met a lot of talented artists who are lost.
Yeah. It's very hard if you think that a gallery is also an agent of change and to support the things out of the mainstream, you know? And as we know, the experience is that usually commercially successful in a way either is mainstream or it can also become mainstream, you know?
Of course.
So it's like, what is kind of like your new approach, or your probably not new, but individual approach towards playing these fields of supporting artists, getting in touch with clients, and also keeping the originality and still make a living for all of you?
What you just described seems impossible.
Yeah.
But no, I think there is a kind of balance,
mm-hmm.
between doing all of those things, but I guess you've discovered by now that I have a very low threshold for risk. I just don't.
Yeah.
I just don't acknowledge risk in the way that other people do. And so a lot of the decisions I make are based purely on whether I'm interested in the result. And the way to get there is sort of, even if it's really murky, resolves itself. You leave it up to serendipity, as I said before. But I think it doesn't factor. I don't have all of these things in front of me, and I don't really try to tick all of the boxes other than the formal criteria that I mentioned. It's more about finding an artistic practice. For me, like I'll just make this very clear. I don't think that galleries really are agents of change. I think the gallery model is entrenched. I think it's very difficult to actually change the gallery model.
Mm.
Because it's to this day the only effective way of promoting and highlighting artistic practices, short of being a patron and sort of devoting a lot of material resources towards one or two artists, like a lot of people have in the past, you know, the era of enlightenment. But to me, what's really important is finding the not necessarily loud, but important voices within contemporary art, voices that aren't necessarily on trend, aren't necessarily heard, and aren't necessarily dealing with the problematics that the mainstream art world is dealing with. I'm interested in complicating things.
Mm.
I'm interested in playing devil's advocate. I'm interested in finding counter narratives to those that are dominant. And in that sense, I look for artists who care about those things also.
As we know now, you're a risk taker. Where is your vulnerability in it? Is it that you go so far that you really also risk to get hurt, to open up so far to that field that it might create another energy? Because I don't think actually that it's true that galleries cannot change. It might be just in small ways, but it might be possible. And I believe that there is something in you where you want to be part of that and not just do it like it was done 20 years ago.
Well, no, absolutely. I mean, the whole point of having a gallery is to supplement your lack of artistic talent, I think.
Oh!
I don't mean that as a personal slight to you, of course. I mean that about,
oh,
I mean
no, that, that's
I mean
all right.
that about myself. I mean that about myself. I think that I peaked as an artist in college. But no, I truly believe that it's as you say, you know, you want to be part of something great, and a gallery is a very legitimate way of doing that because you get to nurture voices that become louder over time and that actually do become agents of culture, of moving culture forward, potentially can become influential.
That's lovely.
In terms of galleries, it's not that the gallery model doesn't necessarily change. It's that the galleries themselves, you know, I think have very short-term influence in the sense that, I mean, we are agents of the market at the end of the day. And I think that moving and operating within a market, you have very, or most galleries have very short-term vision. So looking into maybe 3, maybe 5 years, it's not the same as when you're, let's say, an inventor and you're looking at what your invention will do in 30 years. Gallerists aren't trying to be Nikola Tesla. We're just trying to show some art, sell some art, kind of live to see another day and do another art fair.
That's probably part of it. Probably I'm an idealist, but I believe that, well, the market is just the basic thing that has to work because otherwise there's no gallery, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But still, there have been and there are galleries, I think, that had an influence much beyond their generation. And because they were working with artists that had an influence, and they probably supported the artists in such a way that the artists could thrive. So I would give galleries a bit more credit.
I think that's very true. And that's the ideal. That's the role model that we all strive for. At least
yeah,
the, you
exactly.
know, the ones that care.
Yeah, the ones,
the
that,
ones
care.
That really care.
The ones that really care. We want to be them. So you really care. And I'm just going to jump to independent. Is that your first fair?
No, I've done quite a lot of fairs this past year.
You know, we were talking about money and fairs are expensive. But that was something from the beginning
yes.
on you felt it was necessary to do that?
For me, it's necessary because as we've established, you know, I got into this business mm-hmm. without a full risk assessment of what it means to start a gallery without patronage, without clients. And, you know, almost 2.5 years later, I can say that the gallery is stable and I found clients and I found people who will support the gallery, kind of support the programming. But it certainly wasn't a given.
No, but sometimes it's just, you know, I mean, you just jump in the pool and you start swimming.
Yeah.
And
paddling.
Paddling, exactly. Paddling. You know, it takes some years, but, you know, it's like just learning by doing. So independent is coming up and this is why we're talking. And you will have a solo show with an artist,
yep.
Anastasia Komar.
Yes.
So you told me about the formal things you cherish in an artist. So can you tell me a little bit more about that presentation and about her practice?
I would love to. Anastasia is a very special artist in the sense that she started much later in life. She, like me, is an immigrant who moved to the U.S. with, you know, practically nothing to pursue a career as an artist. She was trained as an architect and worked as an architect for a long time. And I've known her for quite some time and watched the work evolve and watched as the sort of formal elements of her training were stripped away. And she immersed herself more and more in that interest, that sincere interest that she has for the human pursuit of godhood, of divinity through science, through technology. I mean, as I watched that, I became more and more interested in what she was doing, and her work was changing dramatically in the last few years until she arrived at this place now where she makes essentially very labor-intensive, almost pointillist paintings that examine color theory, that examine perception, that sort of challenge the established modes of representation, especially of macro and micro scales. And then she began adding sculptural elements to those paintings. She started designing and 3D printing sculptures that hearken to the various illustrations that she would find in medical journals, in scientific publications, which are all, of course, also artist renderings.
Mm-hmm.
And so that epistemological layer of removal from reality, from, you know, the scientific description of a phenomenon, its artistic illustration or depiction, and then Anastasia's appropriation of that, the combination of the description and the artist believes the thing looks like or represents.
And also they are, in an eerie way, beautiful.
They're phenomenally beautiful. Mm-hmm. and arresting and original. I think I haven't seen anything like it. And of course, a lot of artists work with 3D printing. A lot of artists, you know, try to incorporate sculpture into painting. But these look so organic in the sense of their integration.
And at the same time, also very artificial in a good way, I think.
Yes. Yes, I agree with that. And so for, you know, her career took off when we did the show in September of 2022. She had had several solo shows since then, most recently at Shulamit Nazarian in Los Angeles. And this will be her first solo presentation at an art fair. She had shown some work at Freeze in Seoul in South Korea with a Chinese gallery where she had a solo show. But this will be her first focused solo presentation with new, really ambitious work, probably her most ambitious work to date. And so I'm excited about this debut, and I'm excited about the fact that we were able to essentially take a practice that was hitherto unknown until September of 2022 and take it so far in such a short amount of time, just on the strength of the work alone.
That sounds like something really to look forward, and you'll be there with the works at the Independent.
Yes.
So how do you go about when you do an art fair? Because you said you're an introvert.
Mm-hmm.
I assume you're not jumping on people.
I'm not jumping on people.
Do you wait for them to come? What is your personal way to work on an art fair?
My art fair strategy? I think most of the work gets done beforehand as a necessity, a way to mitigate my introversion. But no, I mean, I can be on, I think, when I need to be. And it's about engaging with the interest in the work first and foremost. I'm not particularly good at, you know, small talk or salesmanship in the way that I've seen some people are. But when I believe in something, it's very easy to talk about it. I think that's universally true for most people.
Yeah.
So I'm very careful about only presenting things that I truly believe in. And then I sound convincing even to myself. And I think, yeah, like I said, most of the work and planning goes and happens long before the fair opens. You know, usually I like to enter a space knowing exactly what's going to happen. And so far, I've been successful at that with most fairs.
That's quite contradictory, I would say, because a lot of things you just told me, it was like more or less not planning and just doing
mm-hmm.
without knowing what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not true for art fairs. Is an art fair like a special field?
No, I don't think so. I think that luck needs a fertile environment to present itself. Maybe that's a kind of pseudo-philosophical belief, but, you know, I don't do anything without a plan, or I guess without seeing a path, especially not mm-hmm. art fair.
So you're plowing the field for opportunity.
Yes. I would say, like, I prepare as much as I can and do as much as I can beforehand in any situation. Even, you know, when I dropped out of high school, I had a plan for doing that. It wasn't just like a, you know, spontaneous decision where I decided that today I'm not going to go to school. Like, I knew that I wanted to go to university, for example. So
Independent is going to come up. And what's going to be the next thing at the gallery?
We at the gallery usually program very far in advance. like I said, coming in with a plan.
Yeah, the guy with a plan. Yeah.
It reminds me of A-Team. This is a series I grew up with.
Yeah, me too, actually, funnily enough.
I forgot the name of the actor. I know Mr. T was in it, but the guy that always said the line, "I love it when a plan comes together" at the end of every episode. Love that guy.
He was the boss of the A-Team.
Love that character. Yes, love that character. That had a profound impact on me growing up. And of course, you know, that was like one of the first shows I watched when I came to America. So I do love it when a plan comes together. The next thing at the gallery is a duo exhibition of Amarelle Jackox and Jesse Lee, who are both MFA grads from Hunter University in New York. Jesse is a wonderful sculptor who works with glass and clay. And Amarelle is a phenomenal and very special painter who makes these really metaphysical oil paintings that have an immense presence wherever they are. I remember when I walked in to the Hunter MFA show and I saw Amarelle's work installed for the first time, it completely sucked all of the air out of the room. It was like the point of gravity. There were many other artists in that thesis exhibition, but after I saw those paintings, I didn't need to see anything else. It was like an incredible experience.
That's beyond thinking. That is visual physical reaction.
Yeah.
You gave once an interview with your father with ArtNet, and there you said you had this like awe-inspiring experience for some Paul McCarthy work.
Yeah, I think that was at the Park Avenue Armory.
And so I guess it might be that in the end, you also react to some things in art that can't be verbalized, where it's beyond thought, you know, where it's kind of like really a physical visual experience.
I think the game is that tug of war between the phenomenology of that experience and the attempt to explain it or to make sense of it after.
Yeah, that's all game.
I think that's what's, you know, the trouble of the gambling man, right? Is you always pursue that adrenaline and then you come down from it. But the coming down is part and parcel of the experience. And so pursuing that awe-inspiring phenomenological encounter with art and then trying to make sense of it and trying to kind of compartmentalize it in your brain, I think that's an important part of it, because that's how you expand the understanding. I try not to focus on just that experience of being moved by a work of art, then use that as a way to understand myself. Why am I being moved? What's happening? Am I learning something?
I could go on and on and on, really, to talk to you, but I'm going to wrap it up now, and we're going to continue at another time. So I'm just going to say thank you for now, Anton.
Thank you very much for having me again.
This was a special Voices on Art episode created in collaboration with Independent Art Fair New York. Listen to it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or the platform of your choice, on our website van-horn.net, and in the Independent OVR at independenthq.com. Follow Independent Art Fair on Instagram at independent_HQ, and the podcast at Voices on Art and at van_horn_Düsseldorf. Thank you for listening to Voices on Art, the Van Horn Gallery podcast hosted by Daniela Steinfeld. Stay tuned and connect.